Thanks. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this beautiful place. Okay, this is joint work with Chris Tumescu, who's a postdoc at UCSB, and with Radu Sherbin, a former UCSB postdoc who's now at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. You know, gee, I have to say, this is a little bit embarrassing that I'm so disgusted, so Microsoft-friendly here, I have an excuse. It's not a good one, but it's a consequence of my foray into administrative duties that I don't have time to prepare my own biographs. And so when somebody helps me, I feel that I should let them use their creativity. In any case, this way, it gets better. Okay. Well, it's not. It's for you. Okay. So a little bit on the objectives and approach. The objective of this work is to judge, estimate the quality of the reduced model of a dynamical system. So here we're talking about a nonlinear differential equation system. By estimating its error and its region of validity. And I'll try to define this region of validity thing a little more precisely in a second. Well, there's some linear algebra, but you'll have to use your imagination. okay. Cloud. We should all be happy. The approach, here's just an outline of it. The overall approach is general. I'm going to use proper orthogonal decomposition, POD, as the example method in this talk, but that does not necessarily mean that that's my favorite method. In fact, we started working on proper orthogonal decomposition because I tried it out and it didn't work as well as advertised. So we wanted, you know, some theory behind the POD, and in fact, there's another talk that talks about some a priori error bounds for the POD. But I don't have time to really concentrate on that right now. This is not about POD. So in this method, I'm going to show you the estimates and the bounds of the reduced model errors are obtained using a combination of two powerful ideas, the first being the small sample statistical condition estimation method of Kenny and Laub, and the second being a posteriori error estimation using the adjoint method. Finally, what is nice about this approach, in my opinion, is that it allows the assessment of what we're termed to be regions of validity of the reduced order model. Namely, if I've got a reduced order model that I base on some data, and then I perturb the problem or perturb the initial conditions, boundary conditions, whatever data, and use that reduced order model on the, use that projection to make a reduced order model that's now applied to the perturbed problem, I'd like to know how big of a perturbation I can make and still get a reasonable answer out of the reduced model. Okay, so I'm going to use proper orthogonal decomposition because it's so widely used in reduced models for nonlinear dynamical systems. And we've learned a lot about POD in the past few days. The proper orthogonal decomposition reduction is the most efficient choice in the sense among linear decompositions, in the sense that it retains on average the greatest possible kinetic energy. It provides the best approximate and affine subspace to a given set of time snapshots of the solution. So this is how it's usually used in the differential equation world. There's a snapshots that are made of the solution that are either from solutions of differential equations or maybe from experimental data. They're collected into an observation matrix. Usually the mean is subtracted out of those observations. As you know, the POD method seeks a subspace S and the corresponding projection matrix P so that the total square distance, the norm of Y minus PY, is minimized. I know. Okay. So, Using the, I'm getting very self-conscious. if this goes on for much longer, I'll be like drawing my view graphs with the pens again or something. But anyway, using the singular value decomposition of the observation matrix, the projection matrix corresponding to the optimal POD subspace S is obtained as T is equal to rho transpose, where rho is, so I'm introducing terminology here, where rho is the matrix of projection onto S, the subspace spanned by the reduced basis obtained by the SVD. Okay, the matrix rho, the rectangular matrix that consists of the columns VI, I going from 1 to K, which are the singular vectors corresponding to the k-largest singular values. I think everybody in this room knows these things, but it's just consider it a very quick review. Finally, the error of the projection is given, it's the minimum error, as I said before, over all the different subspaces, and it's given by the sum of the neglected singular values. I think it's the sum of the neglected singular values. The norm squared is, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, that's right, but I didn't say it. Yeah. I have to watch out for you. Yeah.
Why would we want to call this the error? I mean, when you're approaching a different sum, the typical error is, you gain a infinite norm. Why exactly this measure? Why is it called an error?
Well, I don't know. I just took this from the POD. Like I said, I'm not a POD person. This is, you know, if you read the applications of POD papers, and this is what's called the error. But now I'm going to tell you how I think of the error. Okay. As a differential equations person, how they see the error. Okay. So I'm going to let y hat of t be the solution of the POD reduced model, and y tilde of t the projection onto S of the solution y of t of the original problem. Okay, so we've got, here's y, the original solution, here's the subspace S down here, the POD is projecting onto S, okay, but the solution that we obtain by the POD is not the projection of the true solution, okay, right? It's the solution that we obtain by solving the reduced differential equation in the subspace S. Okay, so that's this line over here. Okay, there are, you can think of the error, we think of the error, and we're going to repeatedly use this decomposition of composed of two parts. The first being the subspace approximation error, E perp, which is the difference between y tilde, the projection onto the subspace of the true solution, and y, the original solution, and the second part being the error introduced by the integration in the subspace S, the subspace error. We call it EI of t, and that's the difference between the reduced order model and the original solution projected into the subspace. So here's E perp, projecting the original solution down into the subspace, and here's EI, well, the difference between y hat and y, the error within the subspace. Okay, so switching gears for just a second, I want to do a brief introduction of this little piece of technology that we're going to use, the small sample statistical method for condition estimation. I love this thing. So the idea is for any vector V in Rn, if V is selected uniformly and randomly from the unit sphere, Sn minus 1, then the expectation of the magnitude of V transpose V is equal to this number called the Wallace number that depends on the dimension of V times the norm of V. So in other words, this is a way of estimating the norm of V in cases where I have a hard time getting V, okay, to take its norm, but where I might have an easier time getting scalars Z transpose V for randomly chosen Vs, okay, and that is going to be the case here. Okay, so we estimate the norm, okay, using this expression. So all we do is we just solve for the norm up here, Okay, so our estimate of C is equal to the magnitude of Z transpose V over the Wallace number. And these Wallace numbers, you know, come from statistical analysis, and this is what they look like. This method was introduced, as far as I know, by Kenny and Laub in 1994. But for the purpose of, oh, here comes some linear algebra, of matrix condition estimation. Okay, and we've also used it for the purpose of matrix condition estimation in a little bit different way than Kenny and Laub did. Now, you can make this estimate better. Okay, so there's a theory about how, which I'm going to get to in a second, about how accurate this norm estimate is. You can make it better by introducing additional random vectors. And usually not more than two or three random vectors are needed to get a halfway decent approximation, say, to a condition number where you're really looking for order of magnitude. Okay, so that norm estimate is just given here. Here's the formula for it. Okay, this is Q-th order accurate. In other words, a relative error size gamma, okay, in the estimate occurs with probability proportional to, well, this thing. In other words, let me try to put some real numbers to this. If I want, if I'm trying to do, say, a condition estimate for a matrix, and I want my condition to be estimate to be accurate to within a factor of 10, then this gamma 10, and with one random vector, I believe you have 95% accuracy already of getting within a factor of 10, and with two, it's like 99% accurate. Okay, so how are we going to use this? Just a brief overview, and then I'm going to get some more equations. It's a pity to use all this Microsoft stuff for equations, isn't it? But in any case, we do get the blue sky, and I like that. But, okay, for the norm of E of T of the error vector. Okay, now the error vector is hard for us to get. Okay, I'll show you why in a few minutes. But this is a little bit easier for us to get, hitting the error vector by a random vector Z transpose. So these scalars are easier for us to get. They're lower dimensional information. Okay, for some random vector ZJ selected randomly from SN minus 1, these are going to be computed by an adjoint model. Okay, now, the adjoint method in differential equations is a big old ugly thing. And I don't want to say too much about it, but one thing that it's really good at, just like in linear algebra, is getting matrix vector products, or not to say matrix, not matrix vector products, but vector matrix products, okay? And that's sort of what we have here, a row vector times a column vector. That's hard for us to get. Okay. Okay. So while for one given ODE system, this is not the most efficient way to estimate the error. Okay, there's a much more simple, direct way to estimate the error, which is called the forward model, and it'll just come out on the next view graph very in the first line. That's the most efficient way that I know of. The combination of the adjoint approach and the small sample statistical estimate can be used to estimate the region of validity of a reduced model. So how far can you perturb the parameters and still use the same projection? And how do we do that? We do sort of the same, it's similar concept as in linear algebra where you have a condition number. And you say, well, how big of an error can I make in the right-hand side to get a certain error in the vector x? Okay, and that comes from the condition. Okay, so we have a condition number for the error equation, okay, corresponding to each perturbation. Okay, so now these estimates provide only approximate upper bounds. Just like, you know, if you look at the LINPACK condition estimator, it provides only an estimate of the condition, and the condition itself is an upper bound, okay? So this is an estimate on an upper bound for the norms of the errors, but they have this advantage of allowing, even though it's basically an a posteriori method, when used in this sense to make a condition number, it allows a priori estimates of the errors introduced by the perturbations. Is anybody still awake? I'm going to be a little bit more. I don't know. I don't know. What noise? Okay. You're not getting my noisy talk. Okay, so I wanted to use this and show how this is done in three different situations. And the first is this sort of straightforward situation of estimating the total approximation error of the reduced model. Okay, so to a first-order approximation, namely linearization of the error equation, the total error satisfies this linear time-dependent differential equation system. Okay, and where J is the Jacobian of F, and Q is I minus P, the projection. Okay, now here comes the estimate. Okay, so first let me just say that if we go back, some of us in differential equations have to know this sort of in our hearts, but everybody else can sort of go back to around sophomore year when you took differential equations and there was a big old ugly formula that gave the solution in closed form of a linear time-dependent differential equation. And it sort of looked like this, except for, well, so it looks like E of Tf is equal to minus, and then there's a fundamental matrix. If you remember the solution operator of the differential equation, that's a big, ugly thing that nobody can afford to compute, okay? But we can write it down. Anyway, so you've got the fundamental matrix, and then you've got evaluated at Tf, and then you've got the fundamental matrix inverse evaluated at this S, the integration variable, and then you've got, for this problem, because of this right-hand side, you've got Qf, okay? Well, anyway, the thing is, you can't really compute that because you need the fundamental matrix, and that's a high-dimensional quantity that you can't afford to compute. So here's where the adjoint method comes in. Okay, so it gives us a cheap way to compute, not this error vector, but any one-dimensional quantity that comes from hitting this error vector by a row vector. Okay, so in fact, I can get rid of those two fundamental matrices because I can Z transpose times those two fundamental matrices that were in this thing is given by this lambda, that's the solution of this adjoint differential equation. That's the magic of the adjoint method for differential equations. Okay, so now we have Z transpose times the error vector. And that's just what the small sample statistical method wants in order to estimate the norm of the total error. So if we hit this with one or two or possibly three random Z's, then we have an estimate for the norm of the error. Now, of course, the more efficient thing to do in this case would be just to solve this linearized equation for the variational equation for the error. That'd be the forward method. Okay. And so this whole thing, both the forward method and this thing, which is slightly more expensive than the forward method, several times more expensive than the forward method, but I need it to introduce the next idea. Both of those have the disadvantage that they need to know the true solution, right? Because when you formed this differential equation, you had to know the true solution. So that's not very efficient, but we're not going to use it. Okay, so the next thing that we observed is that you can do something a lot more efficient if all you want is the subspace error. Okay, so this is in P subspace, the proper orthogonal decomposition subspace. Okay, and in that subspace, we can define EIS as row transpose EI, and this is EI is the subspace error. And at the same time, that gives EI is rho EIS. Okay, so just by decomposing the error into the two parts, the part inside the subspace and the part orthogonal to the subspace, you can get a similar kind of differential equation for the subspace error. Okay, now same deal. We can solve that, write down the analytic solution of that differential equation. Again, it's got an ugly old fundamental matrix sitting in here that nobody can afford to compute. But we can compute it again if we hit this thing by a row vector, a random row vector. We can compute that, again, by solving the adjoint differential equation system, where the initial value of, I should say something a little bit about this, this isn't a differential equations audience. So the initial value of the adjoint differential equation is given by the random vector, okay? But the adjoint equation is solved backwards, okay? So the initial value is on the right. In any case, and then once again we can invoke the small sample statistical method to get an estimate for the norm. Okay, but now all this computation is done inside the subspace.
Easier
than what?
You said you found a solution. Can you find a solution for this?
Yes, yes, you find a solution by solving this differential equation backwards.
But this is also an integral form by Maxwell and Newton, isn't it? That it requires computing the fundamental equation.
Right, but this way I'm going to get a condition estimate out of it. Okay, I haven't gotten to that, that's on the next page.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so here's the condition estimate. I should go back for a second. Hold on. Okay, if we look at this piece down here, so here's the norm of the error, okay, and here's this part, okay, that comes from the analytical solution to the error equation, okay, and it's got the adjoint solution in here and whatnot, and it's all multiplying EPIRP, the projection error. Now the projection error we all sort of have some kind of a handle on, right? That's the part that has to do with the sum of the singular values that we neglected. But this part over here, the subspace error, that's the part we're worrying about, okay? In any case, if you were thinking of trying to, which what we're trying to do is get a condition estimate, okay, then I'd want to know how big is this relative to EPIRP? Okay, the projection error. And that, of course, is all being multiplied by this stuff over here. Okay, so here is where the condition number is coming from. Okay, so we can define theta j as, well, this is really just the transpose of what I was just pointing at. Okay, and then we can define these little kappa j's, little sort of internal condition numbers, as follows. Is this what I was pointing at? Sum, and then take the integral. Okay. So then it follows immediately that the norm of EI, the error at the final time, is less than or equal to some condition number, this condition number, in fact, times the norm of EPIRP, the L infinity norm. Okay. Where this guy is the estimated condition number of the subspace integration error. Okay. So finally, for the norm of the projection error EPIRP, we have that the L infinity norm of EPIRP is less than or equal to we know that one, right? That's the projection error. That's the one that's the square root of the sum of the neglected singular values. Okay. So we know this side. Okay, we've now got an estimate via adjoint and small sample statistical method of the condition number. Now we can estimate the size of the subspace error. Okay, so finally, we're getting to why we're doing this. Okay, so regions of validity. Okay, so I want to consider systems that are subject to parameters. And one such parameter is I can make my initial conditions of functions of parameters. Okay, I can have other parameters too, and this whole thing looks very, very similar if I just consider parameters on the right-hand side of the differential equation instead of initial condition parameters. But I don't want to bore you to death if I haven't already done that. I'm really kind of sensitive about this talk because this talk is has got more equations in it than probably. A lot of talks that I've given, the sum of a lot of talks that I've given recently. So, anyway, but it just, I don't know, I tried to think of how to give this without all these differential equations, and I couldn't do it. So, okay, so anyway, so let's let capital Y be the solution of the ODE obtained by applying an initial condition perturbation, okay, and y hat, the solution of the corresponding POD reduced model. Okay, and the only reason this has to be POD is, well, it doesn't have to be POD. It just has to be a projection-based reduced model. That's what we're using here. And believe it or not, a fair number of reduced models and even nonlinear reduced models can be written as projection in this projection-based format. Okay. So y hat is the solution of the projection-based reduced model with p based on y, the original solution. Okay. Now, because we don't want to compute the projection again, that's a really expensive thing. Okay, so I'm thinking in the context of, say, design optimization, where I have my snapshots, I compute my projection in order to define the reduced model. There's a lot of people, you know, in workshops, sort of like this one, where differential equations people and optimization people get together and they're all worried about, you know, using the reduced model inside of the optimizer. And of course, I don't want to redefine the reduced model all the time. I'd like to use the same projection based on my original snapshot, but the optimizer is going to keep changing the right-hand side or the initial conditions of the differential equation, because that's, you know, what it's trying to do. It's trying to do optimal control, or parameter estimation, or whatever it's doing. Okay, so that's a scenario. Okay, so now we're going to define capital E as capital Y hat minus Y. Okay, so that's the reduced model the reduced perturbed model minus the perturbed model. Okay, and then we're going to find del IC as E of T minus E of T. This E of T is the error of the original reduced model. Okay, so if we just solve for E over here, and then this inequality just comes out naturally. Now, what we're going to go after, since we already know the error of the original model, is this term here, the norm of del initial condition. Okay, so del IC, again, we're going to use the same kind of splitting, is split into del perp, okay, which is orthogonal to the subspace, and the del inside the subspace, del I. Okay, and then once again, we're going to use exactly the same business that we just used, but I'm not going to write it all down this time, to obtain a small sample statistical estimate of the norm of del perp. Okay, so here it is. Okay, again, it's written in terms of the adjoint solution. Here's the condition number. Okay, so what we've got is we've got the norm of del perp bounded by this condition number times the norm and the size of the perturbation. Okay, so this is what we're working towards, is how accurate is the reduced order model based on the old snapshots when I perturb the problem. Okay, and note that all this stuff is based on a linearization, right? So if this perturbation like throws us into some catastrophic nonlinear mode, then we're screwed. I mean, all the assumptions are out the window here. So these are fairly nice, well-behaved perturbations that we're talking about. Okay, so just as before, here's the definition of the condition number. Now here's a nice thing for initial condition perturbations. To first order, the del in the subspace is zero because I'm not perturbing inside the subspace at the initial condition. The perturbations just grow inside the subspace starting from zero. So to first order, this doesn't introduce any additional subspace integration errors, hence here we are, a bound and an estimate on the error due to using the wrong subspace given the size of the perturbation. Okay. So here's some numerical results, just a few comments on them before I show them. And there's only one. There's only one slide, and then I'm done. And I think I'm going to be really glad when I'm done with this talk. Okay. So are you. In any case, The estimates and bounds I'm going to show are obtained with 1, 2, and 3 random vectors. And I'm going to show 2 results. There are more results, but I only want to show 2 because I just don't want to show a whole bunch of things. It may be better to comment on a few things. The first is going to be the total approximation error. Okay, so that's the first thing that I did. Okay, the error of the reduced model. And the second one is going to be the error bound on, no, there's more than one view graph left, I'm sorry. There's 2 problems I'm going to show this for. The error bound for the norm of the perturbation error as predicted by the condition number. Okay, so the first problem, I was going to start this talk by saying that there aren't any linear problems in differential equations. In 25 years of work, since my PhD, 26 years of working, since my PhD in working in differential equations, I have never seen a linear problem, except for model problems. Okay, so here's a linear model problem. the next one will be nonlinear, though. It'll be highly nonlinear. Okay, so here's an advection diffusion equation in 1D. It's got some standard kind of boundary conditions and initial conditions. We have 2 parameters, P1 and P2. Okay, multiplying the first and second spatial derivatives. Okay, we're going to use a very standard formula central differentiating. We're going to eliminate the boundary values. By the way, you notice I'm not doing any of this for DAEs because, well, it was a hard work to do it for ODEs. So we got tired. But in any case, we obtain N ODEs in the usual method of Wien's kind of way. They depend on 2 parameters. We took the parameters to be P1 is 0.5, P2 is 1. And the number of discretization points n to be 100. Okay. The POD projection matrices were based on 100 data points equally spaced in this time interval from 0 to 0.3. All quite meaningless to you. And me too. Okay. So here were the results. So this one is the total error. The black line is the error by the forward method. Okay, the little dots here that go along the black line is the exact error because we can compute that in this easy problem. NK, this axis here, is the size of the subspace for the POD. Okay, so we wanted to see how good our estimates were for different subspaces. Blue is 1 random vector, green is 2 random vectors, and red is 3 random vectors. So as you can see, red is kind of getting in there finally. Okay, here's the more, and I've already told you this is not the way I would do this problem, but I think it is the way I would do this other problem. So the second graph is the approximation error E as a function of the initial condition perturbation for a size of the reduced space of 5. Okay, so this is a pretty crummy reduced space. This axis down here is the percent by which we're going to perturb the initial values of that problem and base the subspace on the original unperturbed problem. Again, this is by forward error, but now this is an expensive computation because you'd have to do it for all possible initial value perturbations. Okay, and that was the whole purpose of getting this bound here. Blue is 1 random vector, and green and red are 2 random vectors. So notice we expect this to be a little bit bigger than the true error because it's a bound. Okay, so the second one comes from the CWI test set. Oh, it's not CWI anymore, the University of Bari test set. This is a solution of, this is a set of ODE problems and DAE problems that the initial value community came up with when they decided that the earlier test set that we relied on for 20 years was too easy. it's not that hard of a problem. It's a highly stiff, nonlinear ODE system consisting of 25 chemical reactions and 20 chemical species. Okay, so dy dt equals f. By the way, my own personal view on nonlinear model reduction, I totally agree with what somebody said. I think it might have been Jacob when he said that POD does not necessarily save you any computation. Is that you who said that? Who said that? I don't. Somebody said it. Okay. Somebody said it yesterday. POD or any projection method, any linear projection method, does not necessarily save you computation time. I've had some sort of little minor skirmishes with the dynamical systems community about this. But we did an operation count, and indeed it doesn't. Unless you have, but it's obvious, unless you have, you know, a lot of structure that you can exploit to advantage. But like when you solve a chemically reacting system, where's the cost? Okay, believe it or not, the cost isn't in the linear algebra. It's in the right-hand side. There's a lot of ugly, big ugly terms. And unless you can get rid of some of those terms, there's no hope of, you know, just taking a linear combination of them doesn't get rid of them. Just because it reduces the size of this y. And what it does is it reduces the size of this y, but it increases the complexity of the right-hand side. So you end up doing a little bit more work than before. Okay, but again, I'm not saying use POD or don't use POD. This is just, but I think what got me started on this is that dy dt equals f. This is not the way I would think of a chemical problem. Okay, if I wanted to reduce this model, I would, and have, look at the structure of what composes this f. Okay, because that's the only way that you're going to get at all those expensive terms and get rid of some of them. Okay. So in any case, here we have a lot of exponentials over here. Arrhenius reactions, e to the minus of RT kind of things. Okay, so the POD projection matrix was based on 1,000 data points equally spaced in this time interval. Oh, I'll be right. This is the last secret. I can't believe this. Okay, so here's the approximation errors. Here's the total error. Again, the circles are the exact error, okay, or the best approximation we can make to the exact error. This black line is the forward error. These are the three successive adjoint approximations. What can I say? It's a hard thing to do for a highly nonlinear problem, but I think that these adjoint approximations are starting to do a reasonably good job. Here's the bound on the error as a function of perturbation in the initial condition. The perturbation here is going from 0 to 1.5% in the initial values. You know, so I sort of envision, you know, you've got your initial condition over here. You've got your time-dependent solution. It's moving over here, right? And you'd like to know, you'd say, well, it's a good enough model if it lies within some band, right? And, actually, we're only looking at the final error, so we're cheating a little bit, but let's say, okay, I've got my initial error, I've got my final error. If the final error lies within this ball, I'm happy, right? So how big is the ball over there and the initial error? That's what we're going for. This here is the true error. Again, extremely expensive to compute because you've got to do lots of perturbations over here. Here are the bounds by the adjoint method, and, well, they're converging. They're, you know, maybe half of an order of magnitude off. To me, I feel rather happy about that. So that's all. I don't know.
In the linear differential equation, it does not have a linear solution under it. fat kid.
So, if I can just argue by analogy, in solving linear equations, we have all kinds of techniques. There's the condition number, and there's the condition number estimate that we get all met by. Sometimes we have other techniques, for instance, where we can actually estimate the error independent of the condition number, and we have another technique. But recently, some of us have been thinking about stochastic errors, because all these errors are bounds are often based on the assumption that the errors occur in the worst possible way, and maybe stochastic errors would be a more reasonable way to approach this. Now, is this somehow coming close to this idea that the errors that you get in these systems are stochastic, or is your model just based on the maximum error with some sort of stochastic element tossed in?
Okay, well, so I'm a little bit confused about the word stochastic, and then differential equations, and stochastic differential equation would be when we add white noise to the right-hand side, and I don't think that's what we mean.
No, what I'm referring to is, for instance, the round object or in some algorithm might be stochastic.
Oh, so maybe you are thinking about that. I'm not sure how to answer that.
So, in your model here for the error, it's a fixed model, it's not a stochastic model.
It's a fixed model where I may have some uncertainty in the parameters, and I'd like to know if I'm surveying a good result.
Yeah, but your condition number estimate is based on a Monte Carlo or a stochastic estimate.
Yes.
So you showed how to do error estimates for preservation of initial condition. Is this also valid for preservation of this function?
Yes. This part about the cost EI being conveniently zero is no longer true in that case. But there's an analysis that looks almost line by line.
I tried a hard one summer, even work with the one static fishing shadow to using that for contact and things. It's very special.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Right? If you have the contact vector, this identity then it's not true.
Do you get any information?
No, you cannot divide. No such thing as that.